Welcome to Community First, a show where First Union organisers, activists and community leaders answer your questions and discuss the issues facing our communities. Community First is proudly brought to you by First Union, where we put workers first.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robin Wilson-Whiting. I'm from First Union, and I'm joined by Gary Cranston from Unite Union. Welcome, Gary. How are you doing?
How's it going, Robin?
Yep.
Very good. Yeah, awesome. So this is Community First Radio. We have a regular show at this slot every Wednesday, really talking about the issues affecting our community, often from a union perspective, talking about things that are affecting workers, affecting migrant workers, immigration. Last week we had a good discussion about immigration and the effect of the proposed changes from the government how they might affect migrants, and particularly migrants that are being exploited in their workplace. And we're doing a lot of work on that at First Union, as well as UniMIG, which is the migrant network within First Union. And this week I've invited along Gary from Unite Union. They work particularly with a lot of low-paid workers, particularly politically focused on the issues that, you know, affect all workers, really, like First Union. And I thought it'd be really useful to get Gary along so that we could talk about the concept of climate justice and just transition, which is obviously affecting everybody, and is something that we as unions need to put a lot of work on to make sure that there's a plan for workers going forward. But maybe, Gary, you can give listeners a bit of an idea of what, at least what you think, just transition is.
Yeah, I've just looked up an article that I wrote on our blog when I was in Paris at the climate negotiations, because I remember there was a bit of a good description, I think, of what just transition is in that, because it's a pretty huge subject, I suppose. So a just transition means moving to a low carbon and climate resilient economy that maximizes the benefits of climate action while minimizing hardships for workers and their communities. So there are millions of different ways of doing things about climate change and addressing environmental problems, but not everybody is impacted by environmental problems in the same way, and not everybody is responsible for them in the same way, and not everybody has benefited from the things, the drivers of climate change, like economic activity, that then may cause other people to be hurt or damaged. And this is where the whole concept of environmental justice, I suppose, comes from. And just the idea of a just transition, as in justice, a transition with justice, so a change in our economy and relationship with the environment, that is undertaken in ways that are fair and effective for the people who are affected by the problem.
Yeah.
So Unite Union, for example, is a very hugely diverse union in terms of its membership. We've got members from low-lying Pacific Islands and parts of the Indian subcontinent that are severely on the front lines of the problem, and that's fairly obvious that if someone's homeland is going to go underwater, that's one of the ways that they would be impacted. But sometimes it's not that obvious as well. So we have generally most of the workers, members of Unite Union, are on minimum wage jobs or starting at that.
Yeah.
And they don't have a lot of money. So they would not be able to insulate themselves with their wealth from the problems that are caused by climate change. So a just transition for very low paid workers means one that's not going to disadvantage them financially as well any more than the economic system that is driving
absolutely
the problem.
And I guess part, obviously, concepts like climate justice have a huge different interpretations and meanings to a lot of different people. But to me, another aspect of climate justice, and I think just transitions as well, is that in the way that we respond to climate change being such a huge, I guess, threat to our civilization and that sort of thing, and the way that we run our societies at the moment, is that at the same time, in the way that we overcome those issues, that we're actually addressing a lot of the other problems that we have as well. Plenty of room to improve there. So,
trying to get to a world that wouldn't have caused climate change in the first place.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Another way of looking at it.
And I guess there's a huge amount of different things that are going on at the moment, and we can cover a couple of different topics throughout the show, but I thought it would be useful to talk a little bit about Paris Agreement, upcoming climate talks. If you want to talk a little bit about your experience in Paris last time, and I guess getting a bit of a sense of the political will, or more importantly, lack thereof, of big political actors, but including unions as well, to really address the core issues of the drivers of climate change. And I'm sure that we'll have plenty of time to talk about other issues. Any of our listeners, if you're interested in this topic, if you have anything to contribute or questions, please call in. We're here in the studio. Our number is 815-8100. That's 815-8100. So we'll just listen to a song first so that we can get things started. So this is Another Green World. Another Green World by Brian Eno, where you're listening to Community First Radio. My name is Robin, and I'm joined by Gary from Unite Union. We're focusing today on the issue of climate change and the concept of just transition, which is making sure that there is a plan, that the way that we adapt to climate change actually makes things better for workers, and makes sure that there is a plan going forward to make sure that we're not just putting everybody else out of a job and the rich get richer, basically. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about the current IPCC, ICCC. There's a million different UN climate bodies that are, probably spend a lot of money having meetings.
UNFCCC meetings.
UNFCCC, thank you.
United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's the 23rd meeting.
Wow.
23rd.
And that's one per year, isn't it?
Yeah. So governments have been meeting for 23 years annually to around this United Nations Convention on Climate Change, which is the basically the international body for governments supposedly cooperating to tackle climate change. So that's where the Kyoto Protocol came from,
right?
And the Paris Agreement being the latest kind of big piece of work,
mm-hmm.
An agreement by governments. So it literally took, you know, until Paris, about 20 years, for them to actually agree on a program, apart from Kyoto, you know, that saying that they should actually do something about climate change, and which is a very long time, really. And they're meeting in Bonn at the moment in Germany. And interesting, I was looking yesterday that outside of the negotiations, there was a massive occupation of a coal mine, with 4,500 people occupying this huge coal mine in East Germany.
Mm.
Lignite mine, I think.
Right.
Lignite coal.
Lignite's the worst.
Mm.
Well, yeah, it is the worst.
Mm.
Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. So when these meetings happen, there's all sorts of things happen around them as well, and meetings of people from movements. A lot of people are very critical of the negotiations themselves as well, and say that they're full of industry lobbyists in control of them, fossil fuel companies, and companies trying to make money out of climate change solutions that might not actually be the best solutions, but could make a lot of money, like carbon trading and other stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the big meeting is on at the moment, and we have a new government here in New Zealand as well, which is has been announcing a bunch of new policies and approaches to dealing with climate change, or continuing old ones like the emissions trading scheme, and maintaining that. And we've seen this announcement of plans to plant 1 billion trees as well, which is seen as a regional development project in one sense, but is really, it's about doubling the plantation forestry estate of the country and the emissions that are supposedly locked up on all them trees being counted against New Zealand's actual emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a funny place, climate change policy. We've got a new government that won't actually commit to won't commit to stopping deep sea oil drilling, which is a very popular call in New Zealand. But will plant all these trees to sort of invisibilize other emissions off the country's carbon accountancy books. So while about half of the emissions are caused by the dairy industry, the dairy industry is not really accounting for them properly. And so one way of dealing with the problem would be just to plant loads of pine trees instead.
Excellent.
So there's going to be a lot of issues around that, issues of fairness and justice, particularly if this does go ahead with the types of jobs that may be created through something like this. And controversially, Shane Jones from New Zealand First now has been talking about getting people off the dole to plant these trees. And I know that Robert Reed from First Union responded to that sharply when that was announced, saying unions will not support, or First Union at least, will not support work for the dole schemes, and people being forced into essentially providing cheap or free or subsidised labour for profitable companies. These are profitable companies, these forestry companies. Why should they get subsidies to employ people that they could just employ anyway? What will they be getting paid? Will they get a living wage? I'm not sure about that. But these are some of the questions that are now starting to be raised.
And I guess for First Union, as the union representing forestry workers, could potentially undercut conditions and pay for those professional forestry workers. I mean, I don't know so much. Obviously, there's a lot more kind of risks in the harvesting of trees, but it's a pretty dangerous workplace as well. You know, do we feel good about sending thousands of people into that workplace that have got no training and have just been looking for any job.
It's one thing. This is where the just transition comes into it. I mean, sort of questions. Is it really fair to just plant a load of trees and use some politically generated offsetting sort of rules, which are just kind of excuses to balance the books in whatever way the government wants to, rather than actually reducing emissions and actually stopping oil drilling, which has, you know, serious seriously threatens communities in New Zealand. Or should the government just actually stop oil drilling and take more direct matters?
Absolutely.
Measures.
Yeah. Big questions. I think we might know the answers, but wait for the government to catch up. I guess the other question is, where is the voice of workers in all of this? And I guess, you know, up until now, you and I have both been involved in a bit of kind of centralised, I would say, high-level union discussions about just transition. And I think, you know, there's certainly a general interest in making sure that there is a just transition for workers. But in terms of there being kind of a grassroots groundswell to be involved in that discussion, I think, I don't know, maybe you've got some comments on that.
Yeah, that hasn't quite, I see, workers have not been engaged with about climate change yet.
Yeah.
And obviously unions would be the best organisations to engage with them as workers.
Yeah.
But that hasn't happened yet. And, well, not really in New Zealand.
Mm.
We did have some union members on the climate march in 2015 before the Paris climate negotiations, but not many. There's, what, 360,000 union members, in New Zealand.
Mm.
That's a great opportunity to talk to people directly about things that are really important to them, their work, you know, and their actual lives, which is something that the environmental movement could really do with, because a lot of the discussions around environmental matters in countries like New Zealand, in OECD countries, developed countries that have developed off the back of a lot of environmental destruction, a lot of the discussions around environmental matters are sort of revolve around things that are not actually happening to people here in a bad way, you know?
Yeah.
They're happening to other people or other people's ecosystems and other people's resources. But with a just transition, that's something that this transition is going to happen to workers in their own lives and their own jobs. And it has to be paid for by someone, by people as well.
Mm.
So who's going to pay for this transition? Who's going to pay for the labour to plant the trees? Who's going to do it? Will workers' taxes that they pay be used to support good, effective climate change policy and initiatives? Or will it be given to companies that can show that they can make as much money as possible out of certain approaches to climate change? That's another thing that's been looked at as well. So I suppose there's different types of approaches to things. You can have a sort of a private sector led approach, and you can have a public sector or community sector led approach. Most of the approaches to most environmental problems in New Zealand are often public sector oriented, I think. Or sorry, private sector. And so an example of that would be something that has been proposed now for, by the new government, which is a green infrastructure, or sorry, green investment fund, where the government will put up $100 million just to begin with, and then establish sort of a almost a bank that can, that private investors can invest in. Loans can be given out to private companies to make investments in certain green technologies, but it would be a for-profit driven initiative.
Yeah.
So that would mean that the projects that get selected would be at an advantage if they make loads of profits, and ones that don't make loads of profits won't be at an advantage in terms of getting access to money like this.
Yeah. So if I want to set up a worker cooperative in a remote part of New Zealand, that could be very good for the community and very good for the climate.
Yeah.
I don't have it looking.
You're getting no money.
Yes.
Yeah. Someone
well,
over here wants to make a, some sort of a another technology or another thing. There's been so many technologies that have been promoted by private companies over the last 10 or 20 years as being, you know, solutions to climate change that have been total failures, you know. And none of them should have gotten any money, you know, because it was just wasted. I'm not sure government should be supporting all of these kind of things. And maybe there could be better solutions that come through workers and through the conversations that workers can have or should be having around this now. So I think that's going to start happening soon, though. That's the good thing. I think the conversations with the workers can happen soon. I know that the International Trade Union Confederation, which is like the World Council of Trade Unions, are developing some resources and a program for doing this, for starting these conversations.
Yeah.
And they've also said that they're interested in establishing, as a part of this project, environmental committees, like a little bit like health and safety committees.
Okay.
But of environmental reps. I was just found out about that yesterday. So I was really happy to hear about that. And I know that...
you mean like workplace by workplace?
Yeah, or, I think so, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So that sounds good. So this is where unions can start bringing democratic processes into these decisions.
Yeah.
And I think that's really good. And I think that should be encouraged as much as possible, rather than a more prescriptive approach where, let's say, some union bureaucrats go off and decide what all their workers want and or what's already hanging around on the table and just adopt and latch onto that instead of coming up with something new. We have a huge opportunity to look at some different approaches to the ones that have been promoted the most for the last 20 years, like offsetting and green technologies and things. We can now start democratizing this, and unions are in a great position to do it.
Absolutely. And I guess as some of the remaining only institutions, public institutions left standing that might have a scrap of criticism of capitalism or neoliberalism, we are well placed to do that. Let's listen to another song and then we can come back to the discussion.
Little room has always been enough.
That was Patti Smith with Smells Like Teen Spirit, cover of Nirvana. I am Robin from First Union, and I'm joined by Gary Cranston of Unite Union. We've been talking about issues around climate change and just transitions for workers, but this is a show where we talk about all different things affecting workers in our communities, often from a union perspective, and it sounds like Unite have had a big victory in the last few days. So, Gary, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, we had a case of a worker who worked for Wendy's,
mm-hmm.
Who ran a personal grievance over the fact that she was not offered more hours of work on her roster,
mm-hmm.
And new workers were hired into her store, despite the fact that it says in her contract that all newly available shifts should be offered out to existing workers before they hire new workers.
And do they, so they've got an positive obligation to give them to other workers. Yeah, they don't have to apply for them or...
No. Awesome. That's the way it is. But those of you who are familiar with the whole issues around zero-hour contracts and the campaign that we ran about that...
Maybe just remind people a little bit about that, because it was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, zero-hour contracts are contracts where workers have no guaranteed hours of work. So every week you could get 5 hours 1 week and you could get 35 the next week and just go all over the place. And you're expected to be as available as much as possible to the company. It was a horrific thing that we ran a massive campaign about and got some serious changes in all the fast food contracts and the public behind it and changes in the law as well in New Zealand around workers having to be available to companies at times when they're not guaranteed to have any work. So this is quite strongly connected to that. It's connected to the model that fast food companies developed for years, and the flexibility in the rostering, or the flexibility for the company but not for the worker, and the rostering systems
and
as well.
Security, yeah.
So workers who don't have a lot of hours or don't have security of their hours are more likely to come into work whenever they're asked to. And that's good for companies because they get all this flexibility with their rostering and they can scientifically manage their rosters to make sure that they never, ever have one single extra person working at any one second, you know, that when they don't maybe need to.
Yeah.
And so if you have that flexibility, it makes it easier to scientifically manage your labour like that and keep your labour budget really low. You know, and if you talk to people in the fast food industry, they'll tell you about how ridiculously understaffed they are all the time.
Yeah.
And it's done by design. It's not an accident. It's not just people calling in sick all the time. They just run the rosters right so close to the bone that's what happens. Anyway, this is important because in all of our fast food contracts, we have got clauses in there saying that any newly available shifts must be offered to existing workers before new workers are hired. And we do that because the companies generally would prefer to hire new people and have, let's say, 40 people employed in one store on 20 hours a week, then 20 people on 40 hours a week, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Their 40 hours a week anyway, want to, haven't been told.
Yeah, so, a lot of our retail employers have followed in the same model.
Yes, So, so it's not just the fast food industry.
Yeah.
So the companies have been so stubborn on this for so many years. They've been just flouting this constantly.
Yeah.
McDonald's are particularly bad on it as well. Especially some of the franchisees.
Yeah.
And I've raised this issue before in stores, and I've literally had posters fabricated showing hours and shifts being allegedly offered to workers, and they never were, you know.
So they've
done everything they could to get out of it, but we took a case and it went all the way to the Employment Relations Authority, and they made a ruling in favour of the worker, Rose, as it was her name, Wendy's employee. And she was back paid up to 40 hours a week for all the hours that she was never offered. So her hours kind of stayed the same as all these new people were being hired. If the company had followed what the contract they signed said, they would have been offering her more hours and she would have gotten to 40 hours a week.
which I think may be the maximum. That's a normal sort of maximum amount
that
we would say would be reasonable.
Yeah.
So she was back paid for every hour up to the 40 as if she did work them, but she didn't. She was never offered them. And she was back pay, or she was awarded twice as much as the back pay in hurt and humiliation for this clause being ignored. And that sends a very strong signal to the other companies that not only will you be paying back the money for work that was done by other workers that you went and hired afterwards.
But you also paid.
That the Employment Relations Authority looks at it as a seriously devious thing to do to a worker. And so recognises the hurt and humiliation caused by that. Because it is a really humiliating thing for a worker who's been trying for years to increase their secure hours of work so that they can make choices in their life and all that. To see new people coming in and maybe getting more hours than they get.
Yeah.
And they've been working there maybe 3, 4, or 5 years. So it's huge. It's really great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe, it'd be interesting for to have a look at the clause in the collective that ruling's based on, because we do have similar things at some of our large retailers. And if we could point to that example, even if it's not exactly the same wording, then, that'd be very good for many, many thousands of workers.
The wording's in the determination, which is publicly available now as well.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'll Google it. but I guess just, I signaled before that we deal with that same approach to rostering a lot in the retail sector, particularly in some large supermarket chains. The idea is just that, you've got this sea of workers who are on very low hours that are desperate for work, they want to work, and they're scrapping with each other to get the extra hours. It creates a huge amount of disunity, a lot of, really kind of awful lack of team spirit, but also, leads to a lot of kind of discrimination, and especially, say, if you feel like, well, I started working here 3 years ago, and since then, and I'm 55, and I've since seen all of these younger workers coming in and getting extra hours. Like, do you see the classic kind of all of the different brands of discrimination being kind of exhibited when it's by the different managers? Is that what's happening on your sites as well?
Definitely, yeah. We have massive amounts of favoritism, over hours.
Yeah.
But over the years, we've made it a lot better by getting clauses like this in.
Yeah.
We have run lots of cases over this before and reclaimed hours for people. It's just we haven't had a determination like this.
Yeah.
That's going to stick before, but we have now. So it's
awesome.
It's really great. Yeah.
Yeah.
It does absolutely creates all this disharmony and competition between workers, which is what employers want, isn't it?
Exactly.
And unions are all about creating the opposite.
Yeah.
Uniting people.
Yeah. Well, that's what capitalists want, is for people to be fighting with each other and not focusing on the system that's screwing them over. Do you find, it seems to be quite an international trend that just low hour, insecure way of rostering a business. Have you noticed any changes overseas, or is there any kind of light at the end of the tunnel with this, or is it pretty much still what they're
food industry?
It still seems to be the preferred way of operating, flexibility for the employer and security for the worker.
It's not a coincidence that they run the same, pretty much the same models all over the world. They're the models that maximize profits and creating competition amongst your workplace, amongst your staff, it's good for that. That's what it does. It does help maximize profits. So that's what they do. We definitely have seen the fight for 15 in the US. rise up and give a lot of hope and a voice to fast food workers over there.
Yep.
And we've seen great wins on a state level as well with minimum wage rises as well.
Yeah.
And some clawbacks as well.
Oh.
Under Trump, though, you know, some
of the
minimum wage rises were reversed, I believe.
Mm.
And in England, we saw the first two McDonald's strikes as well, ever in England, which is quite a big deal.
Yeah. You know,
strong union culture in England, of course, you know, but never has been. It's not been in the fast food industry up until recently.
Mm.
So that's good, yes, and there's definitely increasing union activity around in the fast food industry, definitely around the world, yeah. But here in New Zealand, Unite have been at it for a lot longer, and we've got some really, you know, huge changes in the contracts and a very well developed union. So they don't even have union recognition really in England or in America at all.
Nice one. Well, maybe we can listen to a song, and then maybe when we come back from the break, we could talk a bit more about the minimum wage and the way that the environment's changing.
Mm.
I think a lot of different effects that that'll have, obviously, on workers, but on unions as well and how we operate. So we'll just have a song. One moment.
Living fun. death to everyone is gonna come. And it makes Jose much more fun. Death to everyone is gonna come. And it makes Jose much more fun. Death to me. Gonna come, it makes Jose much more fun.
That was Death to Everyone by Bonnie Prince Billy. You're on Community First Radio. I'm Robin from First Union, and I'm joined by Gary from Unite Union. We're here talking about different issues affecting the community and workers today. We've talked about climate justice and just transitions and what's ahead for the different effects of climate change and the different ways that we can respond to that with workers and community in mind. We've also been talking about a recent victory, so well done to Unite and to that worker that's stuck up for themselves with relation to, I guess, the model of insecurity and poverty of hours that is institutionalised in New Zealand and a lot of different industries, but particularly in fast food. And I just thought we'd touch on the increases to the minimum wage that have been announced by the Labor government, and something that we've touched on before in this show, but I think is definitely an evolving picture for at least for First Union, and I think for Unite and other unions that deal with workers that are close to the minimum wage. But actually I think it will have flow-on effects in lots of different industries, and I guess it can only be a good thing that the minimum wage goes up. There are so many workers in New Zealand that aren't, you know, don't have, you know, proper access to a well-unionised workplace or a collective agreement, and are generally getting very little pay increases. So there will be some good gains for people around the country with what's been announced. So just to remind, the Labor New Zealand First Coalition has announced in the last few weeks that the minimum wage will be increasing to $16.50 by April next year. We've also heard that potentially there will be a second increase to the minimum wage next year, 2018, with a view to the minimum wage increasing to $20 by 2020, or I think the wording's a little bit loose, so it might be 2021, but obviously trying to catch up with a living wage.
Yeah,
and
that'd be good if that happened.
That'd be great.
Sooner, actually.
Yeah. I mean, the living wage is $20.20 right now, and I think will be, I'm sure, increasing again next year. The interesting thing with a living wage, though, is that it isn't, it's not actually tied to increases in the way that they calculate it to increase each year. It's not actually tied to increases in living costs. It's more tied to the average wage increase or the increase to the minimum wage.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys talk much about living wage in your work sites and your negotiations?
Well, we have been as of not this year, but last year's conference when it was announced that Unite's take on it was that the minimum wage should be a living wage.
Yes.
A living wage,
yeah,
you know, or the living wage, or $20 an hour. You know, there's a few different interpretations of where that is.
Yeah.
But the living wage, the campaign that is being run by the Living Wage campaign,
yes,
that's 2020, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah,
currently.
At the moment, and we'll go up, yeah. So, you know, 2020 or 20 or 20 or thereabouts. So Unite has run a number of living or minimum wage campaigns to increase the minimum wage for years. So there was a
One was the campaign to get it to $12 an hour.
Yeah.
And then there was a campaign to get it to $15 an hour.
Yeah.
And we got there, you know?
Yeah.
And there was that massive petition as well, that one of the biggest petitions ever signed in New Zealand, ever.
To get it to 15.
Somewhere around 250,000 people signed it to raise the minimum wage that time. And so now, yes, it's make the minimum wage a living wage, which, you know, is just... Why should people be paid less than they need to live? It's ridiculous. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So, if that's right, if in 3 years it'll be $20 an hour,
mm-hmm.
well, that's not going to be a living wage, actually. So, I think we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that the government have said that they'll be paying people $20 an hour in 3 years. And that is not enough money to live. So,
no, they'll be raising the minimum wage to $20 an hour in 3 years. I think I should know this, but I think that they've announced that they will pay the living wage to directly employed people across the government and public sector. I don't think it yet includes subcontractors, which obviously I'm sure is quite a lot of people, but that's interesting. So, you know, they've got one standard for the minimum wage and another for their own, I guess.
Yeah.
Their own employees, but I guess the interesting thing from my perspective is trying to negotiate in this environment at the moment with employers to say, look, you know, minimum wage is going up, you're going to have to stay ahead of that, and a lot of employers are saying, well, you know, there's going to be, you know, I don't know, 8%, 10%, 15% increases to the minimum wage.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be able to do anything. Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to do anything better than that. This is woe is me sort of situation. But that tension between, yes, those are decent increases for working people and they will definitely have an impact. But how do we stay ahead of that?
Well, that's the logic of the minimum wage, you know.
Yeah.
It's you know, you pay your workers this much or it's illegal, right? You know?
Yeah.
And then that sets the bar for, like, what the... Okay, that's what we'll pay you.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
You know, and that's also, you know, as opposed to the logic of the living wage, which is people should be paid enough to live.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. I guess the... what I've come across... I've got one of my worksites that I've just recently... renegotiated their collective agreement for many, many years. They was a pack and save for many years. They were paid the minimum wage regardless of how long they'd worked there, what position they were in effectively. And they've got such a kind of ingrained stigma against being anything close to the minimum wage, which is fair enough. It's, you know, screw all. And obviously through collective bargaining, we've improved the rates of pay significantly over that time. But now the minimum wage is going to be catching up to the rates that we've negotiated. And they, on paper, they're really good rates, but pretty soon they'll look shabby in those workers' eyes. And I can appreciate that. But I guess, do you find that same kind of feeling towards being on the minimum wage, so to speak, being close to it in the fast food sector?
Well, the fast food sector has always been sort of known or seen as being a minimum wage sector. So we've brought in all these steps for workers to get off the minimum wage as quickly as possible, get off the starting rate. But that's been a part of the, you know, 12 or more years of Unite's negotiations with these companies.
Yeah.
It's taken a very, very long time. I could tell you that Burger King, up until about maybe 3 years ago or less, I think, had at least 80% of its staff were on minimum wage.
Right.
So, and you don't... not easy. It's not easy to get much higher than that, no matter what you're doing in there. I mean, I've come across people managing restaurants on less than $16, $10 an
hour. That's insane. We've actually come to the end of our show, so thank you so much, Gary. You've been on Community First Radio, and we are again next week on Wednesday, 5 p.m. Thanks.
you for listening to Community First, where we discuss issues facing our community. For details on how to join First Union, please go to our webpage, firstunion.org.nz. We'll be back every Wednesday at 5pm, or you can listen to us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/communityfirst.